So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week it is Windows Week. It is Windows 11 week. It has been finally and officially announced by Microsoft. We are recording this podcast right after the launch event, so all this news is fresh in our heads, and we're going to dive into what makes this new release of Windows so special. So stay tuned for all of that, and we've got a lot of really different news going on this week, too. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's always super helpful. And you can join us live every Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern to actually see how we record the show. Stay tuned to the end of the episode for our interview with the Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart developers, Mike Daly and Mike Fitzgerald, who works as the core technology director at Insomniac Games. Windows 11. I'm feeling a little giddy here, even after we talked about the Windows 11 leak last week. And, you know, it seems like that was actually very, very close to being done. This final version of Windows 11 that was announced today looks like it has the center taskbar that we saw earlier. It has the revived, the kind of simplified start menu. It's got widgets. It's got a lot of features and some like tablet changes too, that I think just look a little more polished than Windows 10. Sherlyn, what is your big takeaway from this event? Because I know you're a big PC nerd like me.
Yeah. I will say, if you guys haven't heard last week's episode of the Engadget podcast, where we kind of went more in depth with the Windows 11 leak, it's worth a listen just to see what's, you know, a bit more details on what's new. Having seen this more officially now, I really like the look of it. It seems very clean. A lot of people were right to draw comparisons with Mac OS, but you know what? OSs are all going to look like each other a lot soon. The big thing that jumped out at me, in addition to Panos being very emotional for some reason the whole time.
That's every reason.
That's every Windows event, of course.
I once visited the Microsoft campus just to talk about a device nobody cares about, the Surface Hub 2S, you know, the giant monitor.
Yes, yes.
And I spent an hour walking around the campus with Panos as he just like gushed about this thing. So I think that is just his mode. It's not even like camera mode. That is, he is just like all in Microsoft Windows and everything. Right. I do kind of, it's a little weird at times, but I also do kind of appreciate somebody who loves their work. Yeah.
There are people who are like that. But one of the things that we got a closer look at in this official unveil, at least, is that they're, you know, the App Store or the Microsoft Store is getting Android apps. I thought that was one of the biggest pieces of news that was dropped with no fanfare, just near the end. And it's like, okay, look, I know that Android App Store has some quality issues for sure, but there's a ton of them, which was one of the biggest problems with Windows apps, and that there being none of them, right? Like, there's close to none if you want to make a Windows a mobile-friendly OS. So this is a big step in that direction of making Windows a more mobile/touch-friendly device. And the way they say they'll integrate it into Windows 2 doesn't look like it's just going to be an emulator window limited to, like, I mean, it's going to be vertical orientation because that's how the apps are mostly built, but because Android can't build for wide screens anyway. But
and it's going through the Amazon store too, which is
Amazon
wild.
App Store. Yeah, or with the Microsoft Store, some of them seem like. But also it's integrated into the task bar, the start menu, probably also with desktop shortcut icons. So proper integration of Android apps, it looks
like. I'm sure we're going to hear more about how this is working too, because it sounds like there is some like Intel virtualization technology going on here.
Yeah,
all these apps are coming right from the Amazon App Store, which means no Google apps, right? It means like very specific, you could get some of the more popular Android apps. And do you think this would be a good thing for Windows in general, right? Because like you were saying, the biggest problem with the Windows Store, the Microsoft Store so far, certainly with 8 and 10, there aren't many really compelling apps. And I think a lot of Windows users still just go to the websites that they're used to download normal Windows apps, right?
Yeah, I do think that, like, once you have Windows on, once you have all these apps, right? Windows on ARM mm-hmm. becomes more of a compelling sell.
Yes, true.
So much more of a compelling sell. Like, okay, now you refocus that messaging for Windows on ARM. Don't just say that it's about mobile apps. It's about more like a tablet experience, right? Because then I get it. Then I'm like, oh, then these apps have to be downloaded from the App Store. And yeah, you have the desktop experience if you need it. But your primary means of interacting with Windows on ARM should be more to think of it as like Android apps. Could be, you could still use it to download apps from the desktop. But I think with that compatibility issue, the concerns over compatibility might be less huge. I don't know. I'll have to use a machine to see.
We have to see. Let's paint a picture for people. So if you missed last week's episode, Windows 11 looks similar to Windows 10. It has a center taskbar, which looks like it's just all icons now. Before in Windows 7, Windows 8, you could actually turn on labels so you could see, you know, the titles of the screens in your taskbar. That's actually how I normally run Windows. Doesn't look like that's an option here in Windows 11. And that may change things for some people. Personally, I preferred having the titles, but I've also been using this Windows 11 leaked build for a while, and it's fine. I've gotten used to it. But the other cool thing is this thing called Snap Groups. In the taskbar, you could basically make icons that launch several different apps at once. You know, so if you're a big Evernote user or something, you could launch Evernote plus your Slack plus something else at the same time and have them arranged in the windows in the right way. That's something we should talk about, because they probably did some underlying work to rearrange how Windows actually handles Windows, because now it's just smarter. If you have an external monitor plugged into your laptop and you remove it, all those windows from that external monitor don't just get like jumbled up on your main screen. They get minimized and just put into the taskbar very neatly. It also looks like it does a better job of remembering exactly where you're putting specific windows, which is super annoying when you if you restart or if you change the resolution for something or a game changes the resolution and all your windows get like moved around. That's always been a big problem. It seems like the OS itself has ways to do that now, which I really appreciate. Any thoughts on those, Sherlyn?
I do think that the whole idea of this style of window resizing, Panos and probably Microsoft were pitching it as adapting to you and your needs, right? This is kind of that whole Windows 10 X-like thing that we were supposed to get with if you have multi-screen experience. And instead of a proper multi-screen device, now they're kind of pitching it for like, oh, we're fixing a multi-monitor issue. But it does look like it'll be, you know, smooth, fluid, flowy. I still want my resizable windows for myself, but it's also a new shortcut I'm going to have to get used to, because that's not really currently how I use my laptop. I'm very much a one window, one screen all the time person. But that's it. I can see the convenience. And yes, it does seem like underlying it needs to adapt to the size of your window, the size of your screen, and, it, you know, some kind of tweak happened mm-hmm. behind the scenes here.
It's basically some like minor frustrations. I don't know. There's also this thing with like the HDMI connections where it's like when you plug in an external display, everything goes crazy on Windows sometimes. So it does seem like they've like locked that in a bit better. In the video we were just showing, we saw some widgets on the side of the screen. They're calling them web widgets. They just look like tiny little boxes, you know, like the widgets we've seen in other OSs. Looks like weather, calendar, things like that. It's not going to fundamentally change the way I use Windows, but I guess it's kind of nice. It's like an at-a-glance mm-hmm. Collection of things to just see a bunch of information all at once, right?
I mean, I still need to see more of how this is being implemented to understand how I feel for it. But again, the way Microsoft seemed to pitch it was a way for developers and creators to get their content in front of you and therefore also make a bit more money off of you. So will it feel like ads? I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but we'll see. Yeah.
I don't know if it was ads, but they did mention, so one thing they talked about was some of the store changes we were expecting, and they confirmed that Win32 apps, the normal like .exe apps, developers will be able to put those in the Microsoft Store, which is something they couldn't do before they had to be packaged as like UWP or Universal Windows Platform apps, which were kind of limited and had to be updated in specific ways. So I do think Microsoft is relaxing things a bit there too. They also mentioned that developers can use third-party commerce solution. So like their own billing or charging solutions. And also Microsoft won't be taking a cut of any of that. So this kind of, this strikes at the heart of the App Store controversies we've seen over the last few months, where Epic and a lot of developers are kind of railing against Apple's 30% cut and the way they kind of take some money from users, so, or from developers. So I do wonder if this could help the Microsoft Store kind of become a little more vibrant. What do you think, Sherlyn? Like, do you think developers will actually appreciate this flexibility versus Apple's like very restrictive controls?
That's a big chicken and egg question, yeah, right? Because clearly Microsoft is doing this because it wants more developers on the store to make the store more of a real thing. And whether developers find it worth their while to, you know, go through the hassle of listing on the Microsoft store is if the platform does bring in money. Does it bring in, you know, users? And yes, PCs are, you know, one of Windows is one of the biggest OSs in the world, especially in the land of PCs. And maybe if, which we need to talk about, by the way, Xbox gaming, the experience, if that does take off, I could see like more and more people being drawn in and maybe seeing this as more of an app first OS. But like I said, chicken and egg, right? They're both kind of waiting for each other to gain popularity and then come on board first. So it's really hard to say.
It's hard to say. Microsoft has been trying really, really hard to make its app stores a thing over the past, honestly, over the last decade, even more. That really just started with Windows 8 in like 2012. And developers didn't want to have any of it. People, like normal users, didn't want to go to the store to download their apps. And it took them kind of a while to build things up to where they are now. One thing we didn't talk about is the new start menu. And they, I don't think they actually spent much time on it, right? Because it is like we described last week. It is a collection of your pinned app shortcuts at the top when you hit it now. There's some suggestions at the bottom. There's a button you can hit to see the entire start menu. I don't think a lot of people are going to miss seeing the whole start menu, but do you have thoughts, Sherlyn, or do you miss the like live tiles from the Windows 10 and Windows 8 start menus?
Not at all.
Nobody like used live tiles.
Yeah, like we talked about last week, I like this cleaner look. Nobody used live tiles. I didn't need to see the weather in my start menu. I like this cleaner look. I like the centralization of the icons on the taskbar as well. And I like that you have the option, based on your experience with the leak anyway, to bring it back to the left if that's where you prefer it. Options and choices are what users need, even though you're trying to go for a new look. I will say that from our live chat audience, by the way, came a good question by Kev, because we were talking about Android apps coming, you know, to Windows 11 and that being powered by something called an Intel Bridge. So Kev's question was, will these Android apps be supported on devices using AMD CPUs? And that's a very good question. That's something I'll have to ask Microsoft soon, but it's worth thinking about. If this is dependent on silicone, then that's also kind of a kink in Microsoft's strategy, I think.
We'll see. I don't imagine that would be a huge thing, but it could be the sort of thing like where some processors have hardware decoding for, 4K video and some don't. And some may require a little more CPU usage to do that. So maybe there's like a performance hit, which could be the more likely thing. Intel Bridge, I got to look more into this technology. We got to like dive deeper into a lot of this stuff, folks, because we literally just heard all this news. So bear with us, please. But by the time we're ready for a full review this fall, I'm really hoping to dig into all how all this works. I do think like maybe that'll be a slight advantage for Microsoft, but what we've seen over the last year too is that AMD's new processors are really fast and are really pushing Intel to do better. And they're doing a lot of work even at a cheaper price than Intel's hardware. So I don't know. We'll see. I just upgraded to a Ryzen 5800X on my own desktop PC, and I'm seeing like major speed advantages there over my old Intel chip. So it's going to be a give or take for a lot of people. We just don't know at this point. But I don't think it'll be like you can only run these Android apps with Intel chips. That would be insane.
It would be. I mean, speaking of like hardware, right? Near the end of his keynote, Microsoft also acknowledged its different partners from AMD to Intel to Qualcomm. And shortly after, my inbox, I just took a look, has already received all these emails from HP, Acer, Dell, all saying they are committed to Windows 11. And the big question is, again, this is a big question from our live chat. I'm sure it is on our podcast audience's mind as well, release date and availability. Now, in our chat, there is speculation. I can't remember exactly the username right now, but someone said that it will probably be released on the Windows Insider program on June 30th. Now, I don't know where you're getting that date from. Maybe you've seen it already live somewhere. We are still catching up on the news. But, you know, as always, the Insider program is more for people who are a bit more maybe developer track or have more of an interest in checking out pre-release software. So, you know, that is not the public availability.
Although it's really easy to get insider builds now. Like, Microsoft has made it super easy because they literally just want as many people running these things as they can to get some feedback.
Will say, in one of the press releases I saw from, say, Acer, they did say Windows 11 later this year. So, I mean, again, that's a big window. We are in June. That gives them about, like, almost 5 to 6 months to play with. But again, I do think Windows 11 is coming this year, and it's no pricing was announced, but I don't think Windows is going to charge for upgrades.
Well, so the thing that that kind of dropped, even as this event was beginning, was Wario64, our favorite like Twitter deal user, tweeted this note from another user who pointed out the Windows PC Health Check app, which tells you if Windows 11, if you can actually upgrade to Windows 11,
right,
does say it's going to be a free upgrade. So we'll see. We'll see. For now, in our story, we're saying, like, yeah, that app does say that. So we're going with that for now. It's weird that Microsoft didn't say anything, right, during the presentation. Because I was also writing as we were, like, as all this stuff was happening. So it's easy to miss some bits.
Same. I didn't catch all of the ending when Satya was talking because I was writing out that Android app's post. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's certainly a free upgrade. Once again, based on that Wario screenshot, based on what we know of Microsoft so far. And I also, by the way, would encourage you to stay tuned to Engadget.com. There are later info sessions from Microsoft later today, so we'll probably have more details to share.
Oh, it's very exciting. This is an exciting time. One thing we didn't talk about was the tablet experience, which I didn't see much of in the leaked build. So it looks like, first of all, there are bigger touch targets. So now if like you want to resize a window, you don't have to be like right finger on the edge of the screen of the actual window. Looks like moving things around is easier. Interacting with touch targets in general just seems a lot simpler. There's also a new virtual keyboard, a software keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a thumb keyboard. It's on the like lower right. I assume you can push it to the lower left. It basically looks like a phone keyboard. On a PC. Are you intrigued by that, Trillin? That reminds me of like some Android tablets and some like even the iPad. I think you can create a reduced keyboard, right, for thumb typing.
Oh, 1,000%. It looked a lot very like Android-y, but let's not forget Microsoft has its own keyboard for Android, and it's made something similar for the Surface Duo that it launched last year. So it looks very similar to me in that sense, but it, you know, it seems like with all these experiments that Microsoft has been doing with things like the Duo, it's bringing some of the lessons it's learned over to the proper OS itself, which is its biggest selling product, in my opinion, and to make it a bit more, you know, thumb-friendly. And that's nice. Although I didn't really like the Duo keyboard on the Microsoft keyboard on the Duo. Yeah, but I feel like that might be because of the Duo being a dual screen device rather than the software itself being broken. I would intrigued. Probably, it looks good.
Yeah, I would probably use a thumb keyboard, like a small one that I could just like move my thumb around really quickly and type rather than the full screen software keyboard that you see on a lot of Windows tablets. There's no way to type. It's no way to live. To be honest, a couple other nice tweaks we saw in the tablet experience. It looks like if you rotate from landscape to portrait, your windows just kind of reorient in a nice way. It's very like organic. So if you have one window on the top and one on the bottom, they're going to just like switch over very nicely. So I'm really intrigued to see how Windows 11 works on Surface devices and, you know, other Windows convertibles and 2-in-1 PCs. Maybe this could like breathe some new life into those computers too.
I will say a lot of people in our live chat are alerting us, and I just double checked. The Microsoft website does say that Windows 11 is coming later this year, and lots of people are saying it's going to for sure be a free upgrade. So, hey, for those people listening to this podcast the day after, you might already know. But just so you know, lots of people, you can already see the information on the Microsoft website.
We're getting a lot of this in real time. So they talked about some gaming stuff too, real quick. It does seem like some of the features from the Xbox Series X and S will be popping over. So the audio HDR feature, which can basically use AI algorithms to create an HDR layer on older games, that's going to be headed over. They say over 1,000 games are going to support that. That's really interesting to me because it's like it is a big graphical change. If you have a monitor that supports it or if you're playing on a 4K TV, that you'll get more dynamic lighting, you'll get better colors. I was playing a bit of Alan Wake when I was reviewing the Xbox Series X, and like that game wasn't built for HDR, but it actually worked out pretty well because that's a game with a lot of dark spaces and stuff too. So that's cool. And what else? It's the direct storage API, which is, I think, a little more nerdy, but I believe that just allows for a faster throughput rate between your disk drive and like the actual hardware on your system. So basically faster. Things are going to be faster. Games are going to load faster. Hopefully we'll see some of the like crazy good load times we're seeing on new consoles too. So to be expected. I'm not too surprised we're seeing those features. Any thoughts, Trillin? And there's the Xbox app too, which we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this I've again been contemplating, and I also promised people on Twitter that I will become a gamer this summer. So this will be my way in. Obviously, I won't get Windows 11 by then. By the way, according to the Windows website, the upgrade rollout plan is still being finalized, but for most devices already in use today, Microsoft expects Win 11 to be ready sometime in early 2022. That's for devices out there today. So it's a while to wait for sure. So for me, I can get on Game Pass now and just play on whatever I have. And then my devices, when they upgrade next year. And you need to check your system requirements, of course, to see if you're compatible for an upgrade. And if it is, it will be free. Then I will have the new experience. And maybe that'll turn me into a real gamer, I guess. But for now, I can still keep playing League of Legends. I'm good.
You can still keep playing that. And it's going to be a good summer. Yeah. And Steam. It's going to be a good summer for Xbox Game Pass Ultimate users because you can play a lot of xCloud games. You'll have a lot of free stuff too. Any takeaway thoughts, Trillin, on what we've seen from Windows 11 so far?
How about a takeaway thought on what we didn't see, which is, I think we were, ahead of every show like this, our team gets together and we're like, okay, what do we expect them to show? Especially if we're not getting pre-briefed. And one of the things we were like, maybe a super wild card thing we might see is the Surface Neo. Devendra, do you think the Surface Neo is dead?
I don't think it's dead, but I do think they realize a lot of work probably had to be done with both Windows and maybe their hardware. Because the Duo, I think, is still really cool, but you didn't like it very much, Trillin, and it didn't get great reviews. And we've seen like, I think Microsoft just realized they may need to take a break. Maybe we'll never see the Neo, but I do hope they at least release it to a few users to at least start seeing how people actually use Windows on dual screens,
For sure.
I just don't think it's going to be a device for everybody like maybe they were initially pitching it.
But it seems like Microsoft is focusing on a software game, at least for this year with Windows 11, and continuing to team up with partners on the hardware side of things. So we'll see. I mean, I think there's more to come. At least later this year, we'll hear more about Microsoft's own devices. Surface device events are usually in October. And maybe that's when we'll see the first, fully native Windows 11 devices come out. Who knows?
Absolutely. And we'll be taking a look at all the preview builds and everything as they roll out. So stay tuned for all that. Let me tell you guys, I've been running this leaked build on a Surface Laptop 4 for the past week. And it just feels nice. It feels polished. It feels a little Mac-like. It feels less cluttered and less cluttered than Windows 10, although I really like Windows 10. So it doesn't really take that much to impress me. But I do think their aim to like cut away at the extraneous edges of the interface, like the title bar, the taskbar titles and stuff like that, does lend to an overall cleaner look for the OS. So I'm digging it. I hope they can actually get this out soon to people because I think people will really like it too. Let's move on to some other news and kind of wild news this week, actually. John McAfee, the controversial founder of McAfee Antivirus, was found dead this week in his Spanish jail cell. It is strange because literally 4 hours before that news hit, we got the news that the U.S. government was going to extradite him back to the U.S. for tax evasion charges, I believe. So this all came pretty quickly too, because I saw the news coming. We were like, if we're going to extradite John McAfee, that's not really news for us. And then boom, this happened. They're saying it may be an apparent suicide. We don't official, like there's no official details here yet, but I just wanted to shout it out because this guy is, he is quite the figure, right? Like he founded McAfee and then basically ran off with his millions to Brazil and elsewhere. At one point, he basically formed a gang, like a militia gang. He is probably responsible, like he's responsible for some things, allegedly responsible for things that could include murder. You know, so there's a Showtime documentary about his life. I'm sure there's going to be like a movie biopic at some point. We interviewed John McAfee in, let me just see here, in 2016 at CES. Wow. When he said he was going to be, first of all, he's running for president. He was running for president. He's tried that several times. And also he was working, he basically sold his name to the startup called EveryKey. But let me tell you guys, like talking to him was kind of a terrifying experience too, because it's sort of like, you ever talk to somebody who you know they're probably high on something or like not quite there? They're like, ugh. And then like I was like pressing him, like, do you really think you're going to be president? And he was getting more and more irate throughout the interview. So I basically ran away from that. That was really interesting exchange. But he is certainly an interesting figure in the tech world. Compare him to like Norton, right? Dr. Norton. Dr. Norton didn't have a militia gang. He's just a guy with a white shirt. He was nice. I don't know if you have any feelings about this, Sherlyn. It's just a kind of a sad end to this story, because I secretly hope like maybe he would turn himself around a little, because he seemed like a really smart guy. His life is basically like Breaking Bad as a real life story.
It's hard because, yes, like you said, this is a controversial figure. He's done a lot of interesting things in his past. I'm going to use the word interesting as a euphemism here.
Yep.
But also, shortly, I think earlier this month, just about 2 weeks ago, he had tweeted about how being in prison was not good for young people. And he had, you know, started to contemplate. It just sounded from the tweet like things were really starting to weigh on him. So the speculation that this might be suicide could be based off of that tweet. I don't know. But again, no matter what it is, death is a very sad topic, regardless of, you know, the person involved. So I personally was saddened at the news, even if I did think that some of his antics in the past were kind of ridiculous.
Kind of. Absolutely. Yes. Let's move on to some news too. The Supreme Court. I don't know if you guys have been following this news, but there's a story about the cheerleader who, when she didn't make her varsity squad team, I don't know, she didn't make varsity, right? She's a JV cheerleader. She sent some Snapchat messages saying F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything with her friends outside of school. The school suspended her from cheer for a year, and her parents were like, no, no, no. Like, this is not fair. So this led to a major, like a lot of court work, basically. A lower court ruled that the school, Mahoney Area High School, violated her rights. The girl's name is Brandy Levy or Levi. They violated her First Amendment rights by basically punishing her for off-campus speech. This week, the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, the school did violate her rights. And they also made some very specific rules too, in terms of how schools handle free speech for kids off campus. And I think that's going to become more and more important with things like Snapchat and really anything, Instagram or whatever. The Supreme Court basically laid out three rules that schools need to overcome if they're going to like regulate off-campus speech. They said that schools rarely take the place of parents when students are away from campus. So basically they can't like do like just random supervisory. You know, they can't just be like, you can't go there. Courts need to be extra skeptical of when schools try to regulate off-campus speech, because that would essentially allow schools to regulate things students say anytime throughout the day. And that's not something anybody should allow. So basically, the courts need to be extra harsh. They demand more
proof about why you're doing something to punish a student because of off-campus speech. They did lay out some things like if you're harassing people, you know, if you're targeting violence or something towards a teacher, that is definitely speech a school can act on, but normal speech, probably not. And they also made the point that public schools, this is a public school, have an interest in protecting free speech because they serve as nurseries of democracy. Therefore, they can't go around punishing kids for saying F school. And I saw the ACLU was, I believe it was ACLU lawyers who were helping on this case. The ACLU has a bunch of apparel right now that's basically F school, F everything shirts, because you have the freedom to say whatever you want. You know, you can say that. You're not shouting fire. You're not like, you're not causing harm to the school. You're just expressing your opinion. So anyway, I think like this is a big deal. What do you think about this, Sherlyn? And also, you're from a place where speech like this is not really
free
allowed. Yeah. So how do you feel about this? How would, you know, high school Sherlyn feel about having this sort of level of freedom?
Oh, no, I feel great. That's the reason I'm in America, is because I could probably never be a journalist in Singapore, which is where I'm from. Hello to everyone in Singapore. Hi. In fairly recent news, Singapore's government just bought out the national newspaper in an effort to save it. So great. Excellent. Okay. But anyway, I fully agree. Free speech is free speech off campus. Like on Snapchat, you're allowed to have feelings about school. You're allowed to be like, fuck school. Schoolwork sucks, but it's different when you're like, fuck a specific person, right? When you're like, I hate
if you're bullying or something. Yeah,
it's a fine line between the concept of school. Well, not that fine a line between the concept of school and a person or a group of people that borders on, like, if it's a group of people, then it borders on hate speech. So those things you can't. But a sentiment like fuck school that everyone shares. Fully do it. Fully, like, schools should not have control over that. And stop being so butthurt about it.
Absolutely. We've got some news from Peloton. You want to take that, Sherlyn? Because I think you know what's up here.
It's tricky. So there was a couple news items from Peloton. The one that caught my eye first, really, was the report from Bloomberg that it is planning on an armband heart rate monitor wearable device. So, I mean, not unlike a lot of heart rate monitors that existed even before smartwatches, right? Some of them, like from Garmin, you strap around your chest as you're going on a run or hiking or something like that. And it sounds like Peloton's device might be more specific like that, and as opposed to a smartwatch. We don't have all the details, of course, and this isn't official. It still could change. But Bloomberg has seen, apparently, details and images of the device. It might have small and large sizes. It will pair wirelessly with the company's bike and treadmills, as well as phones, tablets, and TVs with the Peloton app. And it will help you capture the intensity of workouts with, you know, getting more accurate cardio data, which is one of the reasons I like Apple's Fitness Plus stuff, right? Because you see your heart rate data on the screen. Of course, you can also use, you know, fitness kit, I think is the name. Gym Kit, which is Apple's, wearable stuff for showing up on other gym devices, gym-enabled devices. You can do that. But if Peloton is making its own, this also might be a cheaper way to get a Peloton device, right? Because all of Peloton's devices so far are what? Thousands of dollars. Anyhow, I was interested because they cover wearables. I was like, cool. But then another piece of news came up this week, and you drew my attention to it, Devendra, is that Peloton also just killed its Just Run feature from its treadmill, which was a free feature. And so if you don't subscribe, if you have a treadmill, the Tread Plus, but you didn't subscribe to the Peloton app, you just can't just run anymore. You can't just
do anything.
Use the free run anymore, which sucks. Are you kidding me?
I assume if you're buying a Peloton, you assume you're just going to need to buy a subscription for life. You know, like that is part of the curse of Peloton. But having something of just a free feature was kind of nice. I think this may have been a response to that story that we talked about a couple of months ago about a baby or a child who was killed. I will say there were some updates to this after we all chatted. Peloton is saying it has temporarily removed the basic running feature. it moved it behind the paywall for safety reasons. It is waiving subscription fees for 3 months while it works on a fix for Just Run. And then eventually they plan to make it available without a membership. So it's like a complicated thing, but I think they needed to like fix this immediately so that there aren't any more instances of kids potentially getting hit by this or hurt by this. But yeah, it seems like an ongoing story, I guess. Very strange.
We'll have to pay attention because it certainly doesn't seem like the right thing to do to just brick a bunch of like treadmills that people paid for, paid thousands of dollars.
You pay for Peloton, you never own Peloton, right? And that's a, so maybe sad. We should talk about more about this at some point. But yeah, I was weighing this decision, like, should I get a Peloton type thing or other types of machines? And my wife and I decided just to get like a normal elliptical that is kind of nice, but is far cheaper and doesn't require a monthly subscription because there are so many other services you can use together with an elliptical. It just won't be as nicely integrated as Peloton. I can live with that, though. I could live with that and save thousands of dollars and $40 to $50 a month. Like, I can absolutely live with that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fitness services, there was a piece of news this week, just today, actually. Apple Fitness Plus is finally bringing some features to its service, which it announced at WWDC earlier this month, most prominent of which being the Artist Spotlight series. I don't know if you remember this, Devendra, where you would have workouts set to the music of artists like Lady Gaga, right? Like, so you can have a 20-minute cardio session with just Lady Gaga music in the background, which is really, I mean, I think it's kind of nice, but of course, Peloton also has its version of this. And my article about it is up on Engadget.com if you want all the details. But what I think is interesting is that the first slate of artists we're going to see from Apple in the Fitness Plus service are Lady Gaga, Alicia Keys, Jennifer Lopez, and Keith Urban. These, I think Apple, you know, said that they, well, they didn't, Apple basically noted, I guess, some way that these are artists with like great big catalogs and long histories and energetic music, really great for working out too. And you can
Keith
kind of
Urban?
Some energetic of them actually music? Sounded kind of okay. Some of them, some of the samples I saw.
I'm not knocking his music, I'm just saying like upbeat. Oh, yeah. Exercise music? I don't know.
Or you want like to rage cycle to images of a tractor. I don't know.
Lady
like,
Gaga and J-Lo, I can understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Alicia Keys. Some of her beats are more upbeat or her tracks are more upbeat. Like when I was writing this news post up, I was like, oh no, I want to pick Alicia Keys songs as an example, but what? So I was like, let's start with Falling as a slow, you know, slow start, right? Falling.
Yeah.
And then let's go to Empire State of Mind as like a great, like, anthematic chorus. And then like, what more? And then I went with No One. I was like, what? Tell me your viewers and listeners, send me your Alicia Keys songs that you work out to. How about that? Because I can't come up with it.
They would have to be like techno remixes or something, right?
Maybe. I don't know. They could be. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyway, if you're a Fitness Plus user, which by the way costs $10 a month and requires an Apple Watch tied to your account, you'll be able to work out to these themed classes soon. And they'll be across categories like HIIT, yoga, dance, cycling, and treadmill, which is cool, I guess. You know what's actually super ridiculous and funny? You know how after you work out a sweat, I'm coming up with the greatest transition in the world
right now.
You know how after you work out, you need to like throw your clothes in the washing machine and like give them a good wash? Yeah, you know who came up with detergent this week? NASA and Tide.
Okay.
Because they made space detergent. NASA teamed up with Tide to make the first laundry detergent for space. So I don't know if you guys know.
How does that work? Do you have a sense of like how, because basically I watched a lot of astronaut stuff growing up. Anything related to liquids or water or whatever, kind of tough for astronauts. I think they basically just like do really simple sponge baths when they can. Mm-hmm. How does clothes washing work? Like how do you even dry it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know about the drying just yet. I suppose they have machines that are specially
designed for this. Just hang a clothesline outside the spaceship and
maybe
the lack of gravity. The vacuum of space will cool it.
Well, this is a fully degradable detergent that works in a closed loop water system, like the ones aboard the ISS, the International Space Station. So you would, I think, use water to clean the clothes. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I mean, this is just test run for now, right? NASA is testing the detergent in 2022 on the ISS. It's calling this test Mission PG Tide. I don't know what that's a reference to, if anything. But it will also gauge the ingredient stability in space, as well as the effectiveness of stain and odor removal.
Interesting.
So we'll see. I mean, look, astronauts.
And this is a closed system too. Yeah, astronauts. Yeah. What? This is a closed system too. So this stuff has to be like cleaned and reused too. So I don't know.
Yeah, and you said how to dry the clothes, right? Like, do we throw a line out the window?
No. I'm joking, because they would just immediately freeze. Yes.
Yes. But other studies are in the works, and they will explore the possibility of a washer-dryer combo that could be used for things like Moon and Mars missions. We'll see. But that was a very interesting hit this week in a very kind of wild week, right? It's
We're in our fun stories mode.
We're
right
in the
now.
Fun story zone right now, but it has been kind of a week. I know you were a little bit on vacation earlier this week or on time off, and I don't know if you did any Prime Day shopping, Devendra.
No, not really.
Yeah, I did, because I'm a sucker. I look.
Yeah,
I hate
it's a
to
big
give Amazon.
It's a big thing for us, and I know people have been talking about this. It is a big thing for tech sites, because you could get affiliate revenue and stuff from that. Hey, that's if you want sites like Engadget and others to survive, like, that is unfortunately like one of the ways we could do it right now. I don't have to like it, though. Man, it is it is kind of sad sometimes. Yeah,
we will be fully transparent with you here. Mm-hmm. At least personally, I do hate that I give so much money to Amazon, especially on things.
Oh,
like
yeah, and I still order a lot of Amazon stuff. I'm just saying, like, this holiday is particularly weird. Yeah.
Yeah, this Prime Day itself, this event, it is a created thing. It's completely manufactured to make money. And obviously, it's a little silly. But anyway, if you guys bought something fun, let me know. Guess what I bought?
What did you buy?
I bought a Tamagotchi and a Digimon for about $10 each.
Oh, man. So, and that's going to be, you said you were going to start gaming this year. That's just going to be all you do. Because I know you, Sherlyn. You're going to sit there and just like beep, beep, beep your Tamagotchi.
Clean poop. Clean poop and clean poop. I might train my Digimon, but with my past history with Digimon, all I got were the shit monsters. So, unfortunately. But, yeah. We'll see.
Other fun stories. There's a new show coming to Netflix that you'll probably like. It is called Sexy Beasts. It is called Sexy Beasts. It is a show about putting people in elaborate prosthetics and makeup. Gosh. And having them go on blind dates together. So how excited are you for this show, Sherlyn?
I've already seen a version.
Yeah, you've seen the British one. This is based on a BBC Three show from 2014.
I mean, I'm excited. I love it. I love all the ones that I've seen were completely ridiculous. But I like the concept, right? And Netflix has done these concept dating shows for a while now, where it's like
Love Is Blind and a whole bunch of other ones. Yeah.
Would you like this person if their face was just a chimpanzee or a shark or an alien creature? Would you still be into them? And the answer is not simple at all. Jesus Lord, the faces on this trailer.
I don't know where this trend is going to go, by the way. Like, how elaborate are these reality dating shows going to go? Like, this person is trapped on a burning building. Do you like them enough to save them from the burning building? You know, they're being held captive by a Bond villain. Would you like to have a first date? I don't know.
I don't know.
That would actually be a fun show to watch.
I am here for the wild dating shows. I will watch. I watch a lot of dating shows already. So, yeah. So that was another piece of fun news this week to, I guess, lighten up what was otherwise a pretty busy, intense week.
Crazy week. Sexy Beasts coming soon.
To Netflix.
July 21st. Let's move on to what we've been working on. I don't know what's up yet. I may have some follow-ups to the Microsoft news. The Vive Focus 3, the new standalone headset from HTC Vive, that is, reviews are out for that now. I just got one in a little late, so I'll be playing around with that for a bit, see how that works. And also the Vive Pro 2, I got shipped that late as well, so I'll be working on a review with that. So I'm going to be VR heavy for a little while. What's up with you, Sherlyn?
Lots. This week we published some of the reviews I've been working on for a while. The HP Elite Folio review is up. My OnePlus Nord N200 review is up. In addition to this week being a Windows week, we also had, briefings and whatnot. And there is more to come, right? MWC might not be really taking place, but companies are still releasing news tied to that event. So Next week is going to be pretty MWC announcement heavy. I encourage you guys to stay tuned to Engadget.com for that, or just, you know, listen to this podcast where we give you the rundown. And also, speaking of MWC, Samsung on Monday is hosting an MWC event. It's already announced, and it will show off the new watch experience, which we've already sort of talked about when they announced it at Google I.O. This is going to be the new Wear OS. I can't wait to see what it looks like. I hope they show a lot more. I hope they show us a device. I still have no idea what to expect, but next week's going to be pretty crazy, you guys. Pray for all of us.
Oh, boy. Pray for us. Pray for Mojo. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. What is up with you this week, Sherlyn?
Okay, so I have, as always, three entertainment picks. And number one is something that I've been trying to low-key keeping to myself for a while now because I'm like, it's so good, but I don't want to tell anyone about it. But so I spotted this TV series called Manifest on Hulu a while ago.
And oh my God.
It was live back then. It was still airing. It was like the current season only. And then now Netflix has it on, all the older seasons are on Netflix too. So go ahead, Devendra. Shade, throw all your shade.
No. I've read that Manifest has become really, really popular since it hit Netflix, but also. Yes. This show was like, we saw so many like post-Lost, like weird mystery shows.
We were talking about this last week. Yeah.
How is this? How does this compare to Fringe? How does this compare to like good sci-fi that you like? Yeah.
Yeah. It's exactly like those post-Lost shows that we were talking about last week. And I absolutely love it. I mean, okay, look, Josh Dallas. I love that he's in something other than Once Upon a Time. Josh Dallas is the main dude who acts as Prince Charming in Once Upon a Time.
Yes, I remember.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I love him in this. He always plays these like good husband, good father types, at least in the two shows I've seen him in. He also looks a lot like former Bachelor Sean Lowe, and they all both give off big good dad vibes. Not daddy, but just good dad vibes.
Good dad.
And he plays that character super well in this show. The mystery is really cool. The sort of the mythology that they're building out is really intriguing as well. Now, here's the premise. In Manifest, a flight takes off on April something, 2013, and disappears. 5 years later, it lands, and none of the passengers have aged a day. But they do start displaying new abilities that just mostly... They seem to be getting psychic warnings.
Did they just take the idea from the 4400? Did you ever watch the 4400?
I have seen the 4400.
Again.
Yes, exactly. Except for we're starting with a flight of 191 passengers first.
Ah, different number. Okay.
Yeah, different number. But then and no spoilers, but there's more. There's just more. Anyway, if you like the 4400 in a more modern setting with some characters who are insanely amped up for some reason, check it out.
Sure. You know they're rebooting the 4400. That's going to be exciting. I want to see what that's going to look like. Yeah. So if you like, if you want like a good mystery sci-fi show, by the way, folks, check out the 4400. It's a little bit X-Files-y. It's a little bit X-Men-y at times too. So yeah, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Anything else?
Now, I have two other recommendations. They're kind of related to each other. And this one is also not surprising to anyone. I saw 2 weeks ago, Bo Burnham's Inside. It's a comedy special on Netflix. It's wildly depressing, but also insanely good. It's not my usual style of stand-up, and I will get to that in a little bit. Bo Burnham is more of a musical stand-up guy, and so he writes funny songs, and he performs them. Mm-hmm. And they're great. If you don't have the patience to check out the whole special at a shot, go on YouTube and look for clips. I think the individual songs have been released there, too, even on Spotify. Check out my recommendations. Me and Valentina Palladino, our commerce editor, were talking about it. White Woman Instagram is a really good track. And then just so many. But I think that's like the lead one. Check it out.
It's really
very funny.
It's funny because like Bo Burnham is like one of the first YouTube creators, right, to become kind of a big star in his own right. He has starred in movies. He was in, Promising Young Woman?
Yes.
Really good in that. He directed a movie. He directed Eighth Grade, which is a fantastic movie. And then apparently, once the pandemic and lockdown started, he locked himself in his room and just like worked on this thing for most of 2020. So it is, as a creator, I'm really intrigued by him. And I really enjoyed this so far. Mm-hmm.
This special, again, not for the faint-hearted, because it is very claustrophobic, depressing. The direction is amazing. Don't get me wrong. Like, he's very creative with what he's done in that limited
space.
And
he had to shoot everything himself. He had to, like, do all the production work, which is also
the lights, hard. Everything.
Yeah, it's hard, but...
He did really great, but again, you watch him deteriorate into a complete mess at the end of it. It's kind of harrowing, but talent, genius. So
that's
go
all
check
of us.
It out.
It's all of us, yeah.
If you want, though, for real, the type of stand-up comedy that I typically love is actually more British comedy style. So I grew up on things like, I didn't grow up, but like I used to really love things like Michael McIntyre, and Dylan Moran. So those are my two older stand-up picks for you that are more traditionally funny. Eddie Izzard is also funny, of course. But I also loved a lot of stand-up comedians that I no longer support.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are all the ones with CK in their name. Like,
I hear you.
Louis Cook? I don't know. Lots of C's and K's. Funny, but not so funny anymore, right? On hindsight. Mm-hmm. So I still like Michael McIntyre. And Dylan Warren's Black Books is another good watch if you've ever got the time for it. So that's me.
Absolutely.
Comedy mixed with depression.
I have a recommendation for you just there, too. I want to shout out the Underground Railroad. Once again, I think I mentioned it before. But this is the Barry Jenkins show adapted from the Colton Whitehead book. About a young slave girl who has managed to run away from her plantation, but also it's a world where there is an actual literal train, you know, moving Black people from the South and to safety throughout America. I've watched like half of the season now, and just have to say, like, it is another harrowing thing to watch, but I think it is really, really interesting and so well made. It is sort of like one of these Southern slave stories, but with like a magical realism tinge to it as well. So there is a lot going on. And I really like all the lead actors. I like Thusu Mberu, who plays the lead Cora. Joel Edgerton, an actor I've always really enjoyed, he plays this like very dogged slave catcher who is like out to catch her. And also we get to learn more about him. I honestly don't care too much about that character, but you get to see how his perspective interplays with Cora, and it is just so beautiful. The music is incredible, and I think it is worth the experience, but it's a harrowing watch. So I've been like piecemeal, basically watching a piece and a piece at a time. I think it's something everybody should see, though, because it also can give you a lot of good perspective into what's going on today in America. It's basically a work of art, so please watch that. Something a little lighter that I actually just binged last night and want to recommend to you, Sherlyn, is the HBO Max show called Starstruck. Have you heard about this?
Okay. I think I've seen
it. This is a show. You've probably... Uh-huh. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, but I've seen the thumbnail for it. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is created by stand-up comedian Rose Matafeo. I believe she's a Kiwi. She's from New Zealand. This is sort of like the Before Sunset and Sunrise series. So it's a rom-com series about a normal kind of like flaky 20-something girl who, is just living a pretty carefree life. She ends up hooking up with a guy who turns out to be a very famous movie star. And that is the
interplay. I've seen the trailer.
Yeah, it's a good trailer. And the star is played by Nikesh Patel, who is also excellent in the show too. So it is sort of like that weirdness of what happens when like a normal person somehow gets into a relationship, and it's not even quite a relationship, but a normal person like basically gets together with a very, very famous person. But that's not all it's about, because I'm like halfway, it's only six episodes, they're really short too. So you can watch the whole season in like 2 hours, I think, but it's not like they immediately get together. It's not like they immediately become boyfriend and girlfriend. There's like a lot of rocky stuff to it. So they end up meeting in different seasons. So the first episode is on New Year's Eve, and then we see spring, then we see summer. So it does remind me of the amazing Richard Linklater films like Before Sunrise and Sunset, because those always took place a decade from each other, of this like relationship of people not quite connecting at the right time. It is sweet. It's funny. It's definitely raunchy. But I think it's a ton of fun. And also, I think Rose Matafeo is fantastic. Like, she is hilarious. And yeah, she has a body type that you don't normally see starring in a rom-com either, right? She's a little curvier than your average HBO star. So I appreciate all that. She's hilarious. The show is really good. Check It Out is a good follow-up if you followed my previous suggestions to see We Are Lady Parts or Hacks on HBO. Great comedy series, so check it out.
That's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at the Slash Filmcast reviewing movies at slashfilm.com.
Send me your favorite tracks to work out to on Twitter. I'm at Sherlyn Lowe. God knows I need them. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
And here's my chat with two of the developers behind Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart. We chat about how they brought this series, it's been around since the PlayStation 2, to the PlayStation 5, what the new hardware in these new consoles kind of opened up, and how haptics have changed things for this series. So enjoy.
I'm Mike Daly, and I'm a game director at Insomniac Games.
And I'm Mike Fitzgerald. I'm the director of the core technology group at Insomniac Games.
Thank you guys for chatting with us on the Engadget podcast.
Yeah, of course. It's our pleasure.
So I've been playing a ton of Ratchet Rift Apart. I feel like my first thing, the opening sequence alone, I feel like is meant to impress the player because you guys are throwing everything you can with the engine. There's a ton of things happening in the background. There's a lot of close-ups on the figures and everything. Clearly, this is a game that's meant to show off the PS5's hardware. So I'm wondering, how did you both, you know, what was going through your mind as you started to hear about what was possible with the PlayStation 5? Did you start to imagine these enormous crowds and, you know, features like jumping through rifts and everything?
You want to go first, Fitz?
Yeah, sure. Right from the start, I think we knew the hardware would have some sort of SSD in it. There'd be an opportunity to show that off. And, you know, introducing a whole new dimension with new characters was a nice way to bring players into the game well. So I think that concept sort of evolved over time. And really, as we realized how extensive the hardware was in the console to push that fast loading, even past the native, you know, speed increase of an SSD, that let us lean into these mechanics further and further.
Yeah, I think another very early on sort of technical effort that we went through was getting ray tracing stood up as well, like making our engine supportive.
Hello, baby time. I get it. I have a 2-year-old, yeah. So this happens to me all the time.
You know, Charlotte has been with me this morning and has been basically like perfect, just playing by herself happily the whole time. I get to hear her making. Like,
once you get on a phone call, yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. You know, the moment I need to be on an interview, that's when it starts. Okay.
Totally.
So as I was saying, ray tracing was another thing that was on our radar from really early on. And so when we first started thinking about what we could do with the PS5, it was about the same time we first started doing ray tracing experiments and figuring out how we could make it work with our engine, how we could make it performant, how we can make it look good, what sorts of things we can do with it.
Gotcha. Could you guys talk about that experience, by the way? Because I've been reviewing the PC video cards for the past few years too. Ray tracing has been slowly coming into all the PC games, but it is kind of confusing how every game implements it. Not every game uses it for all the lighting. Sometimes it's just shadows. How are you guys implementing ray tracing in Rift Apart?
We're focused on using it for reflections, and this is true of our Spider-Man titles as well. We'd put it in to do some shadowing work as well. And, you know, as we worked on these, it became clear that the reflections were really a clear visual differentiator. It was really added something, especially in the city for the Spider-Man titles. And then for Rift Apart, there's tons of curved glass surfaces and futuristic metal places and spaceship cockpits and things where it was adding so much that we decided to say, hey, let's use as much of that power as we can specifically for reflections. So that's where we've focused on for this game.
Gotcha. And I read that, a lot of this engine, this is pretty much the Spider-Man engine that you guys were building on. Can you tell us a bit about that, too? Like, how these two engines are related and kind of how building those games helped you, you know, get into this one?
Yeah, so my team in particular, we work with all the different game teams. We maintain that engine and core technology for the studio and make sure that when we add a feature for one game, it's going to pay off for the next game. And that, you know, we're doing all this work that really pushes the studio forward constantly and isn't just going to get, you know, thrown out when you finish one game.
Yeah. And in fact, I feel like for Ratchet and Clank specifically, obviously, like, one of the game's biggest strengths is its visuals. And I think one of the reasons its visuals stand out is because we're starting with an engine that was geared for photorealistic rendering and has a lot of techniques to make a frame believable. And so when you combine that with a strong sort of art style that's very colorful and obviously, like, more creative, you get this sort of, like, you know, a bright, colorful world that's fun, but has all these, like, believability elements that lets your brain sort of buy into it and makes that sort of creative cartoony world be more immersive than it ever has before. And I think a combination of those two things is just really strong. That's one of the things that makes the game so compelling.
I think one thing I just really noticed too is just the art direction of this game. You guys have so much going on, from the weapon designs to the character designs, right down to, like, the way Ratchet's fur just kind of, like, shimmers and you can almost pet it. Can you talk about the, you know, the difficulty or experience of bringing in bigger art assets or more detailed ones for, you know, for 4K and to deal with ray trace lighting and everything?
Yeah. So I know that our art director worked closely and for a long time with tech artists and character artists to figure out the right look for our heroes, because it's so important. Once you see sort of their final proportions with their final rendering technology, it really makes an impact on how sort of engaging they are. So I know that this was developed over a pretty long period of time with sort of a lot of back and forth between art and tech. And I know for me, one of the points in development where that really made a splash is when we sort of got our first final quality cinematic with facial articulation in, because that's the moment when you see how it's all going to come to life and like resonate with the players emotionally. I know that there was a long road leading up to that tech-wise, because we've got strand-based hair being used for the fur. They wanted, you know, as you said, when it gets wet, we wanted to have a different specular response. We wanted to clump together and sort of be realistic. You know, the eyes are very big and expressive. We needed to make sure that they were believable. They had great reflections, not just in terms of realism, but in terms of, like, artisticness. Basically, that was a big point of focus for several of our departments for a long time, because it makes such a big difference in the final product.
Gotcha. Was it just a lot more work? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say for the faces as well, there are a bunch of points throughout the project where it was, you know, we can push the style this much further if we could do more detailed facial work. And part of doing a realistic game is you have these human faces. We built that tech around that. Human faces move in somewhat constrained ways. And then when we have these, you know, really expressive cartoony characters, there's, you know, Ratchet's face can stretch totally differently. We really had to ramp up, you know, the number of different shapes we can blend at real time in the characters. We didn't get that going till partway through. And it's this really awesome march over the course of the project where it's just looking better and better and better.
I mean, it is kind of astounding to me. I review movies as well, and I just reviewed Studio Ghibli's first CG movie, Earwig and the Witch, and I have to say, there was no detail in those faces. There's very little, like, animation expression, but I'm playing a game now that can actually create characters that do this more. To me, that was just astounding on a technical level. When you guys started working on Ratchet games too, like, this franchise has been around forever. I'm not sure, like, how far back your experience is with it, but was this a vision you guys had for the series from, you know, from as long as you've been working on it?
So this is my fourth Ratchet game. And long before that, we were already like being compared to Pixar movies. Like, it wasn't explicitly our ambition to try and look like that, but I do think that that's what you get when you combine sort of like warm, friendly, colorful characters that are trying to be really expressive and are backed up by sort of like an emotional story that you connect to. Like, I think once that comes together, that's sort of the product that you get. And you know, of course, it's our goal to achieve the highest quality on each of those aspects, like great writing, great voice performances, great animation, great graphics. You know, it just sort of works itself out that way, that it looks like an animated movie.
Yeah, it seems like the logical outcome, but it is astounding to me. There's Ghibli movies, there's Pixar movies I've seen that are, you know, less well-written than what you guys have produced here too. Can you talk about that? You know, what went into writing these characters and these storylines? Because it can be surprisingly emotional at times, you know, for a game series, I think started out that was more about the comedy side of things. This seems very introspective at times.
Yeah, for sure. The story is something that is constantly refined over the course of development. Like, even once we've identified sort of the backbone of the game and the sort of the core emotional themes of each character, we also are developing worlds that we wanted to integrate the story through so that it all sort of flowed together. We kept you moving forward at a good pace, but we also had lots of sort of mix-ups and aspects for pacing. So as we figured out what each level's experience was going to be, we were figuring out how those characters could tie into the bigger plots. Level designers were working with the writers to figure out what a good back and forth would be. What sort of themes do we want to touch on here? And so the script would constantly evolve. And in some cases that would feed back into the cutscenes. In order to get all that sort of worked out in the end, we also had sort of a heroic effort from the folks figuring out the logistics of getting these cutscenes done, because it's a long pipeline. In addition to the writing and the roughs, people at the end needed to add in-game runtime VFX. It needed to be in the audio mix with the rest of the game. Designers needed to script things to either be going on in the background or not be disturbing the cutscene, since it's all running in game. So integrating a story is interesting. It's not at all like making an animated movie where things get locked in and you can rely on them as you go forward. So we had to stay on our toes, and there was a lot of collaboration across a lot of departments involved, pretty much the whole development of the game.
Let me just take it back to the tech side of things specifically. Towards the end of the review period is when I got to test out the performance modes, performance RT, and the even faster performance one. Can you guys break down what the different visual modes offer, just so people know what they're getting?
Sure. Yeah. So we have the default mode in the game is it's called fidelity mode. It's a 30 frames per second mode that basically runs around full 4K and has all our ray tracing effects. Visual effects are fully ramped up to their maximum detail. Crowds and density of scenes is packed full. And then we have the same two performance modes we had in our Spider-Man titles. So one is called Performance RT, which retains the ray tracing, drops the resolution down slightly, thins out, you know, the VFX and scenes a little bit, but runs at 60 frames per second instead of 30 frames per second. You know, we really leaned into the ray tracing in this game to make sure it was critical to the visuals of the title. We do have a mode that turns off the ray tracing for those diehards who want to keep the resolution high while still on 60 frames per second. But that performance RT mode is a really nice middle ground, I think.
Something else that we did to hit 60 hertz is, you know, obviously there is a big discrepancy between 16 milliseconds and 33. So it's not just a matter of like flipping a few switches and changing the resolution. As we were optimizing the game, we also looked at, for particular VFX, like, you know, the weapons obviously have a ton of personality, a ton of like particles and trails going on at one time. We let the artists basically like revisit the hero assets and decide, which aspects applied just to 30 or just to 60 so that they could sort of tailor mm-hmm. it to the frame rate and in some cases use more expensive implementations when we had the extra frame time.
Can you name any of those, like any things we'd notice? Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, the goal is that you do not notice the differences.
I'd say we had them divergent for a while and just spent a lot of time optimizing towards the end of the project. You know, in that last month or 2 months, and were able to bring them back to a point where they're even more similar at the end. So I would say, you know, unless you have a really, really, really critical eye, I think those 60 frames per second mode hold up really, really well to the 30.
Yeah, that's my job, yeah. Unfortunately, is to have that really critical eye. So that is kind of my curse. Let me just break this down. So fidelity is 4K constant 30 FPS, right? And performance RT, what resolution are you guys working with there? Is that 1080 and 1440 or just 1080?
Mm-hmm. I'll say that we do have a dynamic resolution system that's always running to make sure we are at a very, very consistent 30 frames per second. So that fidelity mode, it'll sometimes drop around to 1800 or something like that, but you'd never notice it. The performance RT mode gets up to about 1440p, and we'll sort of sit between that and 1080. And then the mode without ray tracing sort of splits the difference there and gets up to about 1800, but might be around 1500 or something like that.
Gotcha. So that's, yeah, more between 1440p and 1800. Gotcha. That makes sense. Just wondering, what mode do you guys prefer?
I think for me, honestly, I actually can't pick a favorite. When 60 hertz first started working, amazing. I can't go back. And then once the rest of the game's art sort of got fleshed out, I went back to 30 to test things. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. I can't go back. So I've kind of been flip-flopping throughout development. Now at home, I have a nice big TV, so I'll probably go with fidelity mode. But I mean, I think they're great either way.
I think I probably will too. I mean, I spend my days in the office looking at screenshot A and screenshot B and deciding if this optimization we did makes it look worse, right? Or, you know, this new rendering feature we added, look at what it adds to these 5 pixels in the corner. And so I think I just love to see it at full resolution on my screen. So I think that's probably the mode for me.
It is a funny thing because I think console gamers are still getting used to the idea of 60 FPS. And for the longest time, it seems like that was a PC gamer thing, right? And console players were fine with 30. But it's very nice to see that there are options now, certainly. I'm wondering, one thing that could be a nice balance is like performance RT for gameplay and then fidelity for the cutscenes. Would that ever be possible? Or because of the way you guys are structuring the engine, I guess that kind of requires a reboot to switch between modes, right?
Could do something like that. But one of the things we try and do a lot is blur that line between our cinematics and our gameplay.
Right, right.
You know, when you might be in gameplay and then we launch you up into the air and the cinematic plays where you do a flip and come back down and then suddenly you're in gameplay again. And I think, you know, gear changing back and forth between those two would really throw that off. So.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And can we talk a bit? We haven't even talked about the actual Rift parts of this game, but jumping between different dimensions, especially towards later sequences in the game, where you're basically jumping across all the different planets, within a 5-minute period. Can you guys talk about how that works just on a technical level? Are you guys loading up the entire planet's map, for example, if I'm jumping from one to another, or is it just what you're seeing that gets loaded to system memory?
We use a lot of the same open world quote streaming tech that we use in the Spider-Man titles. So when we put you to a new area, we need the high detail stuff that's a certain distance from you. We need the medium detail stuff that's a certain distance further. One thing we're not doing ever is during those transitions, keeping both your starting location and your location in memory at the same time, because we need all that memory to render even one frame of a new planet at the level of detail that we're going for here. So when you go through a rift, we are actually unloading the one you were in and then loading the, you know, entirety of the what we need to present the new one right afterwards. And we can do that in that period of time.
Gotcha. Could you guys talk about just kind of what that sense of speed opens up? Because it does remind me of, like, I guess even during cartridge, you know, gaming days, things still took a while to, like, get to system memory. Now it's like I hit a button, you know, on the PS5 dashboard, I'm in playing Ratchet in 10 to 15 seconds, like, very quickly. And jumping between these different modes is really fast, too. Did that speed, did that just kind of reshape how you guys thought of how you would develop this game or the things you could do with this game?
Yeah, we redesigned parts of the game around knowing that this sort of, like, long-standing constraint was going to be lifted. And you've seen that in the sync planets where you can sort of swap back and forth between two versions. I think it's not necessarily like the first time that's ever been done in games, but they usually have to adhere to the constraints of fitting both in memory or having some amount of, like, shared assets between them. And in our case, we got to be totally different, do whatever we needed to for each side to feel unique and have each side be an absolute, like, full quality, full fidelity, which is awesome. I mean, I think that there are other, we built our game concept around rifts and dimension hoppings, but that's, I think, just one example of directions you could take game design that take advantage of this, that other developers with other games and themes would be able to exploit.
I'm wondering too, one thing that I really loved about the PS5 is the DualSense controller and kind of everything Sony put in there in terms of haptics and feedback and everything. Did the design of the DualSense and, you know, what it could do, did that influence how you guys were thinking of weapons and how the weapons would actually feel as you're playing them?
In a way, yes. So we had already done a lot of arsenal experimentation by the time we started to figure out how we would author controller haptics and adaptive trigger sort of resistance configurations. So the first phase was sort of a blue sky exploration of, like, can we simulate certain real life sensations just so that we could get our feet wet with how we author waveforms, what these configurations can do. The next step was looking at our arsenal, figuring out what seemed like an obvious fit. Like, what could we do with each of these weapons that utilize this to enhance them? And then sort of the final phase, once we had a better understanding of what the controller could do and where our arsenal was at, we started to think about how we could change our arsenal to suit these new possibilities now that we've seen some of them play out. And so it's in that last phase that multiple trigger thresholds came into play for weapons that have multiple fire modes on the same trigger pull. And that's when we started really adding the detailed sort of high fidelity controller vibration to all the phases of a weapon's life cycle. So every single one of them has sort of a unique equip sensation, a reload, charge ups, out of ammo events, all that stuff sort of went in at the end where we really understood, like, the weapon's haptic signature and sort of the suite of responses that feel right for the game.
I think that the haptics are so expressive that it kind of is nice that when we visually put together that are weapons that are unique visually or unique thematically, that can translate pretty easily to being unique haptically, right? We made this awesome suite of weapons, but they're too similar from a haptic standpoint. Like, it's not hard at all to come up with different ways to represent them, you know, physically to the player, which is cool.
Mm-hmm. Are there any of those nice haptic implementations that you guys want to call out that people may not quite notice? I noticed you can actually feel the pitter patter of, you know, Ratchet and Rivet's feet as they're walking around on surfaces, which was a nice subtle effect. But what do you guys prefer here?
Yeah, so footsteps is kind of a good lesson that we learned throughout development. One of our fears going in was many players were dubious of haptics because of their experience with controller rumble. And so the notion of, like, if this thing is going to be going off and rumbling my controller every single time I'm moving constantly, like, I will immediately turn it off. No way will that work. And so we were worried about that. And it was, we wanted to try it though. Like, we felt like we had to, just to see if it worked. And once we got a feel for what were good non-intrusive vibration frequencies and what the sort of range of volumes we could have, and, you know, in a way, like, it seems like making a controller vibrate is very simple, just like give it a waveform. But that's like saying doing game audio is very simple, just give it a waveform, when we know that audio authoring is extremely nuanced, where there's a mix that has to prioritize certain sounds, and it's based off of attention and proximity and all these things. And so we started to apply some of those same lessons to haptics, so that when there's an important response that we want the player to pay attention to, it's allowed to sort of dial down the ambient responses of things like footsteps and bolt collection. That way the player sort of feels what we want them to feel. And so by sort of combining those discoveries, implementing new systems to get them working, we realized that like footsteps don't need to be intrusive. They can be subtle enough and feel pleasant on your hands. And even though they're so quiet, you can still tell the difference when you walk from concrete to sand, or walk into the grass, or even on like a hollow bridge. And it still somehow like just feels right and makes sense to your hands.
I like the way it feels when you smash a bunch of crates and there's a whole ton of bolts, and then they, you know, it's this, it's a lizard brain thing. I just collected a ton of little things.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's very rewarding. There's some Colosseum sequences where I think you're just flooded with bolts, and it feels really good. I guess let's start wrapping up here, but you know, so much has changed for the series in terms of graphics and the overall engine, but I think Rift Apart still feels fundamentally like a Ratchet game. Is that something you want to hold on to, that core gameplay, or were there any ideas or ways to change the mechanics that you didn't have time to include?
Well, so early on, we knew that in order to make a sequel and that sequel to justify itself, it has to change, like it has to evolve. And so early exploration was all about like, how can we evolve? What's going to be new and what's going to be different about it? Naturally, that produced, you know, a ton of prototypes that had to hit the cutting room floor because ultimately they weren't the right fit for one reason or another. Maybe they didn't support the game's themes. Maybe they didn't integrate well into our levels. So we did do that, but we knew that in order to feel like a Ratchet game, and to be worth playing in addition to the rest of the Ratchet games, it needed to have a good story with humor and heart. It needed to have just beautiful, new, colorful worlds to explore. We knew it needed to have an arsenal that was just packed with personality and action. As long as we hit those, then we were sort of free to add on to them with new mechanics, sort of as much as we wanted. And I feel pretty satisfied with the amount of change we made to the formula. It's a little subtle, but a lot of the improvements came in the form of just little quality of life things you might not even notice, like better auto aiming, better camera framing, more permissive transitions between Ratchet's moves that have better animation blending, so it still looks more realistic. We've increased Ratchet's move speed. So just a broad suite of little tweaks and changes make the whole experience feel great and modern, but still like Ratchet.
I'd say sometimes you don't realize the forward march of progress until you go back and play some of the older ones.
Right.
And right. That's when I played an old build recently, or I went back and played some of the 2016 game too, which we love dearly. And then it really highlights some of the differences that have been made to the formula since.
Final question for you guys. It was really nice to see some nods to some earlier games in this. And I know you guys have even revealed some of those on Twitter. But really, my question is, are we ever going to see more Sunset Overdrive? Because I would love that.
Well, you'll probably see more nods to Sunset Overdrive, at least. But we'll let time tell as for a full-on sequel.
Go ahead.
A lot of people in the studio really love Sunset Overdrive and have a huge attachment to it and are super proud of that game. So.
Absolutely. I think that game was underappreciated for its time. So yeah, hopefully it gets more love. Great. Thank you guys so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast, and good luck with the rest of the launch of the game.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.